pepper the banter with some really serious conversation about reproductive rights and the potentially watershed moment, or what was a watershed moment in the US's history, legal history. It's currently playing itself out with the country's abortion laws on the cusp of being taken back 50 years. Laura Lopez Gonzalez is a health and science writer with over 15 years of experience covering health in the global south, looking at the implications of undoing of Roe v. Wade. What does it mean for women all the way down at a clinic? Here in South Africa, how does that ruling implicate a woman waiting at a reproductive health clinic in Harare or in Bulawayo? It has implications of a global scale. Laura Lopez Gonzalez writing in the conversation about the implications of the undoing of Roe v. Wade. Laura, thanks so much for joining us. $12 billion is what the U.S. spends on aid in sub-Saharan Africa when it comes to reproductive health. And while a change in federal policy in pregnancy termination doesn't necessarily affect Africa directly, or a clinic or somewhere where you live, the tone in policy in the US could result in the scrambling for funds for education and even treatment when it comes to unplanned pregnancies or reproductive health in South Africa, Africa, and I guess the rest of the developing world, wouldn't it?
Right. So, you know, Roe versus Wade is just sort of this legislation that, based on the right to privacy in the Constitution of the United States, said it was a woman's or a person's choice, rather, whether or not they were going to have an abortion. That has been argued essentially since the day it was passed 50 years ago. And what you're seeing now is the culmination of a very concerted and very deliberate attack on reproductive rights by the Republican Party. This kind of moment that the U.S. is having undoubtedly, I think, will have impacts on what aid looks like in Africa. Mm. So, you know, you've heard commenters say, you know, it will embolden people. You know, the U.S. sends a lot of money, a lot of influence over here in sort of channels outside of government to support anti-choice, anti-LGBTI movements in Africa. People are saying, well, that's going to be emboldened if Roe versus Wade is overturned. I would argue that's probably already been emboldened. The Republican Party and Christian conservatives in the U.S. are really seeing the fruits of, you know, 5 decades worth of their labor. But interestingly enough, I think what we really might be sort of in store for is tighter conditions around aid and a larger part of aid. So historically, Republican presidents impose what's called a gag rule. And that provides conditions that if you receive U.S. funding, you cannot promote or refer or talk about abortion. U.S. law already prohibits the funding of abortions directly with federal money. But what we see is that gag rule can change depending on who's in power. And we've seen that gag rule become increasingly strict over the previous Republican administration.
And being the dominant Western democracy in which many developing democracies look to, in the change in tone of policy, very much could have waves or ripples of waves in other developing democracies, particularly when you look at, wouldn't say the U.S. Constitution or policy to be the gold standard, but many developing countries mirror what they do in their country based on what they see or the tone or the conversation that happens in a leading democracy like the United States.
Right. And I spent the last week sort of talking to experts around the continent about how they see this sort of playing out. And that is certainly one of their biggest fears, is that Africa is kind of having this moment right now where we have had 2 decades of increasing sort of movements to open up the space for safe abortions on the continent. We have at least 10 countries that are currently trying to very slowly move towards that. And this kind of shift within reproductive sort of rights kind of framing within the U.S. May encourage conservative governments to inch even further back from trying to even liberalize, let alone democratize access to safe abortion. I think it's also worth pointing out that the U.S. has, during the Trump administration, systematically sort of defunded other funding alternatives for many African countries, like the United Nations Population Fund. So as we see this sort of increasing rhetoric within the Republican Party tied to Christian nationalism, many people say that they expect the next Republican administration to gag more types of funding, and certainly, again, in that context where you've already defunded alternatives for governments. Mm.
I couldn't walk in the Cape Town CBD or any CBD in this country without seeing on a electricity box, in a little connection switch box belonging to Telkom or some operator, or even electricity pole, without seeing an advertisement for an abortion, for a backroom, unsafe, unregulated termination of pregnancy. In South Africa, abortion on demand for 12 weeks and less is legal and available to any woman who wants it. But why is it that I can't walk through the Cape Town CBD and without stumbling across an advertisement with a telephone number for a backroom doctor offering a woman an unsafe, unregulated abortion when these services are already available for free in South Africa and safe at a registered government sanctioned clinic or private institution?
Right. I mean, I think that's the big question. I think just to point out to your listeners that abortions are available between the week 13 and 20 weeks. Mm-hmm. If a person feels it, the pregnancy is a danger to their physical, mental health, or socioeconomic status. Mm-hmm. So again, even after 12 weeks, you have a lot of options on paper. In practice, we know that the last time I think I looked at this, and I think Human Rights Watch has done some sort of similar research, but I think only between 5% and 7% of our health facilities in South Africa actually offer safe abortion. It's incredibly fragile, so it often depends on one sister working in the clinic. That sister often faces a lot of challenges in her workplace or their workplace, rather. When I was a reporter, we had health department officials in the Northwest, for instance, tell us that they had to go there because a manager of a clinic that didn't agree with providing safe abortion had locked the nurses out of the room that they performed procedures in. And that manager was never disciplined. I've heard other stories from, you know, nurses who were the only person who was willing to provide a safe abortion in their area. You know, their coworkers would call them Satan or Lucifer. So there was a lot of workplace bullying. And then, you know, when the only person in the clinic who will provide safe abortion gets sick, there's no one to replace them. So one of the things that, you know, former Gauteng head of health, Mandela Masuku, was doing right before he left office was trying to figure out, can't we coordinate a roster among people who will provide safe abortion so that we can rotate people around to facilities so that there aren't waiting lists, there aren't gaps in cares, because, you know, as recently as 2 years ago, there was still, you know, 3-month waiting list at some major Joburg hospitals for this kind of procedure.
Mm. The South African government has, when it comes to same-sex marriages, they have already changed the Civil Unions Act to reflect that if you are employed as a South African employee in the Department of Home Affairs, you cannot, based on your religion or belief, deny someone to be married. That's not the case, from what I understand, when it comes to terminations. Healthcare providers can, from what I understand, object based on their conscience and their belief. But based on what the Department of Home Affairs has already done by saying, just because it's your belief, you work for the state, you are supposed to enact and allow for the privilege which the state and the Constitution allows, should the same be done when it comes to women's reproductive health choices?
Certainly, there's been a lot of calls from public health officials to say, you know, when people say that they're like, it's kind of sort of in common parlance, and it's not the greatest description of the term, but you often hear people talk about a conscientious objector. There's nothing that people sign within the public health system that says, I don't want to perform this procedure. So therefore, like, human resource managers can't figure out if they've deployed a bunch of people who won't perform this procedure into a certain clinic. So when I last looked at this topic right before the pandemic, there was moves within the Department of Health to be like, you know, at the minimum, you have to declare this on your applications because we have to know that we have people who will perform those procedures. So right now it's like, at least in 2019, before the pandemic hit, it was like basically anybody could say that they didn't want to perform it. And then managers were sort of at a loss about what to do.
Laura Lopez Gonzalez, health journalist. Great analysis on the impact of what's happening in the U.S. Supreme Court. Currently, it's on the Conversation website. Go read it. Go inform yourself. Thank you so much.